Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified, and we've got a great show today. I'd like to introduce my co-host with me today, Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And Kevin Stange with the Baker Coastal CPA Firm.
Good morning, Chuck and Carl.
And, you know, guys, we're going to hopefully, if we can connect here on the phone, we're going to have a guest today, Harry Dent. And this is one opportunity for our listeners out there. If you have an economic question, or you have a question about Harry's books, if you've read any of them or any of his reports, he's got a lot of interesting demographics that he talks about what's going on in the marketplace and what's going to happen. And he's an author. He's an editor of a free newsletter service. And you can get his free newsletter at www.harrydent.com. And so we're hoping that we're going to connect on that today. But in meanwhile, we're going to kind of give a little report here about what's going on in the market. We're going to talk to Harry Dent about the market and what's going on. And again, I want to give those numbers out, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And we do have a few lines open, so if you want to call in and ask a question, that's what we're here for today. And guys, we've got a beautiful day here in Portland. I can only imagine how nice it is probably in Tampa.
It doesn't get much better than this. I think this is why people come to Oregon. So absolutely.
Okay, we've got Harry Dent on the line. And Harry, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, and I was just mentioning, Harry, that you're the editor of the free newsletter, Survive and Prosper, and our listeners can go online at www.harrydent.com and sign up for that free newsletter.
Yeah, no, it's simple. You just put in your email and you're done.
Yeah, and I think, Kevin, you've been getting it.
I have.
I've got a couple of co-hosts here with me, Carl Jepson, who's a local estate planning attorney, and Kevin Stange, who's a local CPA firm. And, Harry, we're honored to have you on the show. We got a lot of questions to ask you because I know you're a busy man. The number one thing we get on our show, since it's a financial show, Investing Simplified, we get questions all the time about the real estate market, about the residential real estate market.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. One of the things I keep doing and telling people to look at is look at Japan. Japan's baby boom peaked, you know, a decade and a half before ours did. So their stock market peaked, their bubble, you know, and then their real estate bubble burst. And you know, they've been doing quantitative easing, not as aggressive as the United States up until recently. Now they're super aggressive. But, you know, and they've had endless quantitative easing. And what they've ended up with over the last 16 years is zero growth on average in the economy, zero inflation despite all this endless quantitative easing, and a real estate market that collapsed, bounced a little bit for a couple of years, just like we're doing now, and then went to new lows and is basically flatlined. So what we have in real estate that most people don't realize, I mean, we grew up in an era, especially baby boomers, where after World War II, there was the first middle-class generation in history where many, many people could afford to buy a house and get financing. In the roaring 20s, only the rich could afford homes. So that was a giant surge in housing that put pressure on demand. And then they were followed by the baby boom, which is the largest generation by far in hundreds of years. And we put tremendous pressure, but we're done now. And we've got a new trend, which Japan has shown, where you get to the point where a smaller generation follows a larger one, and there is a point where there are more older people dying than younger people buying houses. What's different about residential real estate and commercial is that it lasts forever, unlike most things we buy. And so, when we look at workforce growth demographically projecting the future, we have to look at the people who are going to enter on average at age 20 to 21 and the people who are going to exit around age 63. That's the average retirement age. Well, now we do the same thing on housing. I expected Japan's real estate to bounce back starting about a decade ago, and you know, when the next generation came along, and even though it wasn't a large generation, it still should have been, hey, now a bunch of 30-year-olds buying, and it didn't happen, and it's because the dyers outweighing buyers, I finally figured out. So now that we look at this, we had a new tool, and we'll project the number of peak buyers, which is age 41, and then we'll subtract the number of people who are going to die on average at age 79, and that indicator has been bouncing in the last couple of years, but it turns back down starting in 2014, and I don't want to act like it's that accurate, but I think this bounce in housing is temporary. It's number one. It's mostly speculators buying. I mean, Wall Street's raising money and turning around now buying foreclosed homes because it's the next place to go after stocks have bubbled up and gold has bubbled up and everything else they've speculated in. And that's not going to last if you don't have real buyers. And if you look at applications for mortgages, that means this is a real young family buying a house on a mortgage that has barely bounced. So this is not a real recovery to me, and the demographic trends, I think, are going to start to be less favorable again within the next year or so. I think, hey, if you're in real estate and you think, gosh, I wish I'd have sold some real estate back, you know, before the crash, well, I'd say sell it this year. And this is not the time to run out and buy a home. I think we've got another leg down in real estate. And for some years to come, that'll be similar to the first leg down. Our rule, Chuck, from studying bubbles, all types of bubbles, all throughout history, is that most bubbles, once they burst, they go back to where the bubble started, not where the bull market started. You know, housing's been growing for a long time, but the bubble started in early 2000, peaked in early 2006. You know, home prices went up 2.2 times in 6 years. You know, in the United States, for, you know, with no big increase in income, just massively more liberal lending. And you know, for home prices to get back to where that bubble started, they'd have to be down 55% instead of the 34% we saw in 2009 and 10. And they bounced up some now. But I think we've got another major downturn. So especially young families who are thinking, gosh, should I buy a home or not? We're saying, no, don't. And the best way to gauge your real estate is to look back and see whether it's an office building or a house or whatever, or a condo, what was it worth in January of 2000? If you're near there, then you're probably may not be too bad a time to buy, but if you're well above that, and most of the housing here in Tampa where I am at is still well above that, it's too early to buy.
What about, you know, you mentioned a little bit there about commercial property, but I have numerous clients that own commercial buildings, and one of the concerns they've had is so many small companies haven't survived, and they have vacant, you know, places in their building for new businesses to get started up, but the new businesses aren't growing as fast as we need to have them grow.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could definitely see that. I mean, commercial has two aspects. It's very sensitive to the economy. I mean, when the economy is slow, or certainly when we're in recessions like in 2008 and 9, and I think we're going to see another set of recessions, probably by 2014, then you get affected by, businesses laying off people, businesses going under, or like even in this recovery, especially small businesses. Large companies who deal internationally have been doing better, but small companies have been struggling, so that's not good for that. And then there's a demographic component of 20-year-olds entering the workforce and 63-year-olds exiting. And that is not favorable until that trend demographically points down until about 2023 and then turns up. So we got another 10 years of, I'd say, an overall difficult environment for commercial real estate. I mean, I'm talking about office rentals. If you're talking about hospitals and things like that, or multifamily apartments, those are very different demographics, and those are more favorable. But office buildings, to me, is a general rule, and there's always exceptions. There's always parts of the country that may be growing, you know, like South Dakota or North Dakota because of fracking or something, you know, or just hot new cities or towns. But as a general rule, I think commercial real estate is going to be one of the worst sectors for the next decade.
Boy, you know, we do have some open lines here at 503-417-7626. 503-417-7626. If you want to ask a question of Harry Dent, economist, author, and editor of the newsletter Survive and Prosper. Harry, you know, one of the other things that a lot of people are concerned about, and, you know, Bernanke keeps feeding the belly of the beast, and we keep increasing the national debt. And how long can we keep printing money we don't have?
Well, I'll tell you how long they're going to have to keep printing, and that's the whole next decade until demographic trends turn up again. And that's what the Fed doesn't get. They think, okay, we had a banking crisis. You know, we can just stimulate long enough to get over this. People have confidence. We'll return back to normal. Demographic trends only get worse, especially between 2014 and 2019, and especially in Europe, which is already struggling more than any major region of the world. They fall off a cliff starting in 2014, and then more and more and more countries. So, you know, all these countries, they're going to have to keep stimulating and keep stimulating even more to fight this demographic tide. And like you say, two things that are happening on the debt side. We have the greatest debt bubble in history. Typical countries around the world, wealthy countries, have four times debt-to-GDP ratios, more than twice what they had in the roaring 20s before the Great Depression. Number one, all this quantitative easing is keeping the banks flush with liquidity and reserves and stuff so they don't have to write down loans for consumers and businesses, which would be to our benefit. I think the banks should take it in the shorts, and then the private sector gets debt relief, and that'd be the best thing for the economy. And that's what happened in the 1930s. The second thing is government debt, like Japan on the leading edge since they've been doing it longer, and now the U.S. and Europe. We keep running up government debt so that even though we have minor amounts of private debt deleveraging, we end up with more debt than before. So if demographics is getting worse and debt keeps rising, we're just going to get weaker and weaker, and they're going to have to stimulate forever. And everybody thinks, okay, we're about done now. It's over. The Fed's turned around the economy, and the next year they can start backing out. No, I think by early next year you're going to see deeper weakness in Europe, deeper weakness in China, and we may see some weakness, especially in the real estate market here. And I think next thing you know, we're in another slowdown. And the question is, when do people finally say, look, you just can't keep running up debt forever? It'd be one thing if it was a temporary crisis and we just needed some short-term liquidity, but you don't fight a long-term demographic and debt, you know, structural problems with quantitative easing. It should be a short-term tool when a major bank fails or a tsunami hits Japan or something. You don't want a short-term crisis to turn into a long-term one just because the whole financial system melts down. That's what quantitative easing should be for. It should not be to keep a dead economy on life support forever, and that's what's happened. We've had 4 years of this, and I guarantee any economist, if the Fed did cut off quantitative easing today, the economy would not prove to be sustainable. We would be in a deep recession within a year.
You know, one of the things that amazes me, I've watched you on CNBC, on Fox Business, and how they always have a counterpart to you. And the end result is I hear a commentator say, I don't believe in demographics. Like, demographics is a religion.
Yeah,
it's
they
a
don't
fact
matter.
Of life.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, how could it not matter? Do you know the difference between an 18-year-old and a 46-year-old? It's like night and day. 46-year-olds earn the most money, spend the most money, they're the most productive, and 18-year-olds cost a fortune and produce nothing. You know, and 74-year-olds, you know, it's a huge difference, and it's particularly huge. I don't think demographics would have been noticed so much, even by me, if it hadn't been for the baby boom coming along and when I was studying it, because the baby boomers have exaggerated everything. I mean, the boom in our economy from 1983 to 2007 was an exact 46-year lag for peak in spending on the birth index of the baby boom. That's all. It's that simple. The boom was not created by the government or government policies largely. It was created by 108 million baby boomers and immigrants earning and spending money, raising families, buying homes, borrowing monies to leverage those home and auto purchases, and now they're not. And they'll never buy again. I mean, like I say, we're going to get to the point where there's more older people dying than young people buying homes and things like that. And so we're going to have a slow economy for a good while. And it is all about demographics. And the second thing is that, you know, the government and the Fed did allow private and government debt to grow from 1983 to 2008 in that boom at 2.7 times GDP. How could any economist anywhere with any brain cells not think that debt growing 2.7 times GDP for 25 years cannot end up in an economic crisis and a period of austerity? I mean, this is insanity, that people acting like we shouldn't have austerity. Oh, we can't do this. No, hey, if you don't want to get a hangover, don't drink a quart of bourbon, you know? And we did that. We can't even compare this debt bubble to past debt bubbles. This is so much larger and so much more global. So there's no way with this sort of debt levels and demographic slowing, and they're not slowing in countries at the same time. Japan came first, you know, in the 90s, and then 2008, you know, U.S. hit that slowdown in demographics. Well, Europe is yet, they're in a plateau. They're yet to hit a slowdown, and they're already in trouble. They're going to start to hit that slowdown in the next year or two. So this demographic, I call it the demographic cliff. It's cascading around the world, and it's just going to get worse. And debt levels are rising because governments are borrowing to offset the private sector, stimulating. And then if you count the balance sheets, that's really borrowing, too. That's creating money out of thin air. This whole thing is insanity. And yet, yeah, I get on CNBC and these financial shows, and everybody like, oh, Harry, you're crazy. I'm like, no, you guys are crazy. This is so obvious. A 10-year-old standing back could look at this thing and say, how do you cure a debt crisis with more debt? How long are you willing to stimulate $1 trillion a year in QE and $1 trillion a year in fiscal deficit? Are you willing to do this over the next decade to fight this demographic downturn? Because if you do, we're going to end up with $30 trillion in government debt and a Fed balance sheet of $15 trillion. I mean, what are you? This is crazy.
Harry, this is Carl Jepsen. I was curious. The demographic thing is really interesting to me. And one of the things that seems to be in a lot of people's mind is employment, but not only employment, but good employment that, you know, makes for so-called living wage jobs. And when I was in business school many thousands of years ago, we had a professor who said there, because of technology and the changes in our country, that there may be a time when there is not enough meaningful work to go around for the population that then exists. And so what do we do then? And it sounds to me like in some respects, I don't know whether the demographics also apply in that situation, but I was just curious seeing what your thoughts might be as to is there a possibility that we really don't have a way to make really meaningful jobs for the people that we have?
Well, ultimately, from all of history, it's called the specialization of labor. Technologies allow us to automate old jobs, move to more urban areas, and then people can specialize in better jobs, and new technologies create higher value-added products and skills. And so there are times when you're transitioning from technologies where, yes, I mean, the technologies are almost automating more jobs and they're creating new ones. But in the long term, I mean, we used to be 80% farmers, trappers, miners, very basic physical work. And now 2% of those people can produce all of that stuff. That we lost all of our jobs in the last century, but they got replaced by factory jobs and then office jobs and technical jobs and managerial and professional and doctors and lawyers. And these jobs are way better. Our standard of living adjusted for inflation had gone up 8 times in the last century in the same time period that we eliminated 80% of the jobs that used to dominate our economy. So it's a positive process in the end. We always end up creating better jobs. I mean, in the future, all of us will be designing businesses and software programs to automate knowledge and products and services, and instead of, you know, doing what we're doing now, sitting in an office processing paper or healthcare claims or something like that. I mean, that, it's way better. We'll have more creative work, more flexible work. But, yeah, right now, with a slowing economy, I think demographics is the bigger factor. It's hard to create jobs in a slowing economy, and so a lot of businesses are hiring more part-time because they don't know if they're, you know, businesses aren't stupid. They know that the economy's running on stimulus and not on real fundamental growth, so they're skeptical. And they're sitting on trillions of dollars that they're not reinvesting, free money, and they're not borrowing much money. The only people borrowing money are large companies, and they're borrowing money to buy back their stock, which is another artificial thing in this fake economy. So businesses aren't expanding as much, even with the economy growing 2%. You know, they're hiring a little less than that, and they're hiring more part-time people. So we are in a period where jobs are not going to be as attractive. And the everyday job, wages are going down, adjusted for inflation, and they've been doing that actually for well over a decade. So we're in one of those periods. But ultimately, new technologies create better jobs. I would not want to go back 100 years and break my back working on a farm. And then people have run off farm. Everybody has this romance about rural life and all this stuff. People have been running off of farms in developed countries and emerging countries. In fact, emerging countries, young people will live in a slum before they'll go back to the rice paddies because it's really hard work.
Well, we do have a line open, 503-417-7626. Harry, I think most people tend to associate inflation with a time of recession and correction and stuff. Do you see a potential time of deflation coming up, or any way that that could work in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. I mean, we are in a period of deflation. Governments are having to inflate massively, and I mean massively, more than any time outside of World War II, just to keep inflation at zero in Japan to 1 to 2% in the U.S. and Europe. So deflation is already the trend. Deflation comes in a period. If you look in history, deflation always follows debt and asset bubbles. When you get a debt bubble, you're levering up the economy, financial assets get levered up, and then at that, some point that bubble's got to burst, the debt has to be deleveraged, washed out, restructured, and financial assets like real estate and stocks and all this stuff and commodities have to come back down to affordability. And that's a good thing. I mean, if things are expensive, how are the next young generation going to afford to live? So that's when you see deflation. It comes once in a human lifetime. The last deflationary period was the 1930s, and that followed a debt bubble and an incredible asset bubble, especially in stocks. 40% of bank lending in the Roaring Twenties went to margin to speculate on stocks. I mean, that's just crazy. And so, you know, we saw deflation in prices when debt was deleveraging. So governments are saying this time around, Ben Bernanke saying, hey, I studied the Great Depression. We don't want deflation. It means high unemployment. It means business failures, bank failures. And you know what? Like I say, don't drink a bottle of bourbon if you don't want a hangover. That is the hangover, and it's necessary to rebalance the economy, to get debt back in line, to get prices back in line, to force businesses to get more efficient and consolidate again after they, you know, had it easy for decades. And governments are preventing that. Well, that's not good. So by all this quantitative easing, we're preventing what we call the winter season, the deflation season, from rebalancing after a bubble boom in what we call the fall season, 1983 to 2007. And it's just going to extend our down process. Japan's been doing this quantitative easing now for 16 years, and they're in a coma economy, and they have not come out into the next spring boom, which they should have starting in 2002. They haven't come into that spring boom because they never dealt with their debt, and now they have higher debt than ever. They started with 60% debt to GDP in government at the beginning of their crisis in the early 90s, and now they got 250%. They started with about 400% total private and government debt. Now they got 550%. Japan's more in debt than ever, and their population is aging and getting less productive faster than any country in the world. This is a disaster in the making, and government has not had the guts to deal with the debt, restructure the debt in this system so that it can relieve the burden. You've got aging households in Japan still paying down underwater mortgages, you know, 20-some years after real estate peaked.
You know, Harry, the debt part of it is always bothersome for everybody. One of the thoughts that always crossed my mind, and I don't know the economy well enough to even hazard a guess, but I was just curious. So, and I heard you say something in the beginning about letting the banks take it in the shorts. And if we would turned the calendar back to 2008 and we would have said, no, banks, you made a whole lot of bad judgments. To heck with you. You go under. Would we be better off?
Yeah, we would have had a Great Depression. We'd have been over it and we'd been growing, you know, faster again. That's what the whole Great Depression, really, if you look at it, was over in 3 years. And then we came out with a 400% stock rally, much stronger growth, because we deleveraged debt. Now, to me, there's a better way in between. That's what I call cold turkey detox of debt. If instead the government says, look, we need to deleverage this debt. Yes, we went too far, but we don't want the whole banking system to just totally fall apart like it did in the early 30s. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, hey, we're going to take a couple trillion dollars or whatever, and we're going to help cushion banks, but only to the degree that banks write down loans for businesses or consumers, especially against real estate that's fallen in value. If you did that, we would get a lot of private debt written off. Yes, government debt would go up some to cushion the system, but net we'd be decreasing debt substantially, and we'd be pushing cash flow long-term back in the private sector. So that to me is like having a doctor get you off heroin by substituting in less and less amounts methadone, a less powerful drug over time. Wean the system down, treat it like a Chapter 11, you know, debt reorganization for business, for the whole economy. We went from $20 trillion to $42 trillion in private debt in just 8 years, from 2000 to 2008. So to erase that bubble, my guess is that we could eliminate $20 to $22 trillion in private debt and take a huge burden off. And the government could actively encourage that. Instead, they're saving the banks, keeping the banks from writing down debt, so consumers and businesses are getting no relief. And we're stuck in this, hey, if we don't stimulate $2 trillion a year, we don't get 2% growth. And that's a horrible deal, by the way. And it's not sustainable to do for the next 10 years. So this is a mess. And if I go back to 2008, I'd say, yes, we give some support to the banking system, but it's literally like $1 for every $4 in private debt that banks write off. You want some banks to go under, but you don't want everybody to go under. You don't want a total disaster and 25% unemployment. So you do it in a more civilized way, but the goal is to get debt down to manageable levels, like, you know, 200% of GDP instead of 400%.
We know, Harry, your newsletter, Survive and Prosper, this last one that you sent out yesterday, actually talked about the irony of the Fed quantitative easing, saying they're helping the majority of the people, when in reality, they're hurting the people they're saying they're trying to help.
Yeah. Normally, governments protect, you know, the everyday person from the powerful corporations and stuff like that. No, this is the opposite. They are saving the banks and the financial systems that benefited the most from the bubble, all the leverage, all the lending, and by goosing up stock prices, they're saving and making wealthier the top 1 to 10% that control most of the financial assets. Homer Simpson doesn't have that much money in stocks and financial assets. They mainly have a house, and the house is the thing that's not coming back that much, and most people are still underwater. So these policies, you know, if they took all this stimulus and just wrote a check to households, we'd be way better off than what they've done. So they're saving the banks. Because their theory is if the banks go under, then the whole system goes under. Yes, temporarily, but the banks will reorganize like they did in the 1930s. the strong banks will take over the weak, and then things will come back, but we'll come back with a fraction of the debt, which means, hey, we lost a couple hundred pounds, and we can run faster again. So even in a slow demographic, my thing, in a slow demographic economy, the only thing you can do, you can't change the aging of the population. Older people are going to spend less money and save more, and particularly not buy durable goods like houses and cars down the road. But if you free up debt levels, if the average person got their mortgage written down from $300,000 to $150,000 in line with the value of their house after this real estate bust, that would make a huge difference in their cash flow for years and years and years to come.
Well, listen, Harry, we really appreciate you spending this half hour with us this morning. And again, you got a brand new book coming out, and people can go online and get your free newsletter, Survive and Prosper, at www.harrydent.com. Very easy to go online, put your email in there. They send it out to you every week. You get a Survive and Prosper. And
actually, it's daily.
It's daily, yeah. And it's amazing the information you guys give. And we tell our listeners, information is power. The more information you have about what's going on and what isn't going on that you don't see, you're a much better investor. So we appreciate Harry Dent. Thank you very much, Harry.
Okay. Thank you, Chuck.
You bet. And for you listeners out there, if you do have a question, you can give us a call at 503. I lost my sheet there. What's the number, Kevin?
417-7626.
503-417-7626. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come right back with Investing Simplified and Carl's comments.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
Let's face it, the rules of retirement have changed. What we were told to do just a few years ago now seems like a pipe dream. Hi, this is Michael Burnett for Chuck Price, owner of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. You know the drill. Be a loyal employee. You'll get a pension. Your home will be worth 10 to 20 times what you paid for it when you retire. So how's that working for you? Call Chuck Price right now. He's located right here in Portland. Featured expert on Investing Simplified on AM 970. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or close to retiring, and he focuses on protection of principal and tax strategies to minimize your taxes. Call right now and get Chuck's retirement report. It's packed full of information on generating more income during retirement, how to leave more to your heirs, and so much more. 503-253-3000. Chuck Price, Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson, and I guess I get the dubious distinction of following Harry Dent, which
wow.
is a bit of a hard act to follow. A very interesting and thought-provoking discussion, and we'll have him on again in future shows, and it'll be an interesting time. And so I can't compete with that, but today I wanted to talk about something that's a little bit closer to home, and this is sort of an open letter, you might say. And it's called Straight Talk from Your Not As Sharp As You Used to Be, But Not Ready for the Nursing Home Parent. And so while this may be slightly tongue-in-cheek, I think it really characterizes what a lot of elderly people feel. So, dear children and to whom it may concern, and I'm not sure who that might be other than the children, but I know you worry about me and I appreciate your concerns. When you were teenagers, we worried about you too, a lot. However, we allowed you the freedom to make some of your own mistakes. When I allowed you to drive the car by yourself, I was worried sick. So what's the big deal if you think I drive too slow now? The point is that you can't protect me from all harm now any more than we could when you were a teenager. So here is what I need from you. 1, allow me to keep or lose my dignity as I choose. 2, I want to stay in my home until I choose to go or an event makes it impossible for me to stay. Falling down at home is no more risky than you driving at 16. 3, Leave my car alone until I can't find my way home or crash it. I'm insured. 4. Don't fuss over my food selection. It's too late for me to eat healthy. 5. If I want to smoke an occasional cigar or have a shot of whiskey, let me. In fact, join me. It will probably do us both good. 6. Just because I have lived alone doesn't mean I'm lonely. What makes you think I want to sit around and play bingo? 7. Don't sneak up on me with any plans you have for me. Include me in the planning process. 8. Don't assume I don't understand. 9. Don't talk to me like I'm a child. Old people have earned the right to be childish, but they're not children. 10. Allow me the respect, freedom, and dignity of embracing my old age to its conclusion. P.S. I will be watching you. And that's the letter from probably every parent in the world.
You know, Carl, that's probably that probably fits 95% or 99% of all the seniors you and I work with.
It really is, and it is such a difficult problem. I don't mean to make light of it, but I see it every day in my practice. Well-meaning children are worried about their parents, and rightfully so. But on the other hand, sometimes the medicine that they give to cure the problem of safety is worse than, you know, the cure that it offers. I don't know how many times I've seen where there's been an active move to move someone out of their house, even though they think that it's going to be dangerous for them to be there alone or with help or whatever. And it tends to start this downward spiral, and they get moved into some new place. There's always a tremendous amount of disorientation. Now, some people get to the point where they say, I don't want to deal with this house anymore, or I don't want to be lonely anymore. I have a number of clients who say, you know, I just got too much for me, and I'm really glad I moved to the retirement place because I have new friends and we get to do a lot of stuff. But a lot of times, just the opposite happens. They go and they hate where they are. They hate what they're doing. They feel like they've been, you know, put away and, you know, rode hard and put away wet. And it starts them on a downward spiral of depression, and they just don't like it. So, you know, I like to think that if you can respect the wishes of the parents, even if they're doing some kind of little bit goofy things, do it.
You know, the other thing I would say, the biggest thing is communicate with them.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of times it's not a communication process. What it is, you know, mom, we got to move you into the home because you no longer can take care of yourself. Well, you know, mom may have some real strong ideas on that, and it's very important to respect those as long as you can. Is there a time when you have to do something? Probably. But by the same token, you know, be mindful of what they want and what the effects of that are. And quite frankly, I know one of the things that is a concern, don't be selfish about it. I mean, if it means that, if what you're really trying to do is say, I don't have the time to look after you as much as I'd like to because I have all the responsibilities of work and kids and all that other stuff, that may very well be true, and it may very well be difficult. But don't impose your need for simplicity on their need for independence.
The other thing I would caution too, people, that if your elderly parent is exhibiting some different attitudes than maybe they had before, the other thing is there's nothing wrong with taking them into a doctor, because a lot of seniors suffer from depression. And I know my mother-in-law was a great lady, and she had a battle with depression for a while. My wife took her into the doctor and got her some medication, and it totally changed everything for her. You know, so it's very important to do that.
You know, that's very true. And there are other things, you know, especially like for example, I know that a number of people have certain kinds of infections that they get, and that kind of infection in a younger person, they just become uncomfortable. But in an older person, they really begin to exhibit, you know, serious signs of dementia, and, you know, even worse sometimes. And yet, people think, oh, well, they're just old and they're, you know, they're getting demented. Well, that may not necessarily be the case at all. So it really is important to not rush into the dementia ward.
Well, you know, as I get older, I always think about that eventually that's going to be me. And,
oh, yeah.
And for every one of us, if we live long enough, that's going to be us. We're going to be the elderly parent,
yep.
And we're going to be the one. So just kind of always, you know, always saying put yourself in the other person's shoes. Well, just always think about your parent when you look at your parents and say, hey, in 50 years, that may be you.
Well, I always like to say that, you know, my memory's real good. It's just a little bit short.
Well, your letter, Carl, reminded me of a great uncle that he was later in his life. He didn't have the ability to walk much anymore, but every year he still crawled out to his potato patch to plant his potatoes and dig it himself. And without that, you know, that's what keeps people going is, having an ability to do that. And those things, so long as it's not, riding a motorcycle or maybe taking a boat out on the river, maybe not the best thing at that stage. But there's a lot of things that you can do for your elderly parent to still provide the life that they would like to live and the things that give them enjoyment.
Well, one of the things you see a lot of particularly males doing when they retire is buying themselves a Harley Davidson and hitting the road.
Yeah, and sometimes they hit it really too hard.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, if you've got a question for us, the number is 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Kevin Stange, the tax investigator. You're listening to Investing Simplified in Portland, Oregon on a beautiful day.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stange, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stange.
You're listening to Investing Simplified here, and it appears that we have our first caller of the day. This is Investing Simplified. Hello.
Hello. Is this me?
Yes, you're on the air. What's your question?
I made an all-cash offer on a home that was accepted. It's a second home. And since the offer was accepted, I've decided to take out a loan from a family member instead. And the reasons just have to do with not wanting to sell some other investments. I want to know if I can deduct the interest from that. My understanding is if I don't register as a mortgage, then I'm limited to $100,000. If I structure it later as a home equity loan. But I also know that there's some rules about how it has to be registered in order for it to qualify in the first place.
Yes, it kind of does. However, there's this concept called interest tracing. And what you are use proceeds for from a loan, if it is for a mortgage, you know, if it's for your principal residence or like you were saying here, a second home, then this interest can qualify for second home type mortgage deductions. So even though it's not, properly getting a 1098 from the person, although they probably should give you a 1098 for the amount of interest that you pay, you can still report that on your tax return and treat it appropriately as a second home mortgage interest.
Yeah, we would structure it as a formal loan. They pay taxes on the interest I pay them, and I would attempt to take the deduction if possible. So it's over $100,000, but not by a lot. But you're saying as long as it's clear that I'm borrowing the money for the purposes of buying the home, that I can treat it as if it were a mortgage for deduction purposes.
That's right, and keep a little bit of a paper trail of how the proceeds came in, and you know if you're using that to pay the cash, show that it is used for that home, and keep that so that it's easy to follow the paper trail. And now you're saying the amount of the interest is going to be over $100,000, or the amount of the loan is going to be over $100,000?
The amount of the loan.
Okay. So if your loans with your principal residence and your second home, if the value of those loans don't exceed $1 million, then you're going to be in pretty good shape to be able to deduct most of your interest without problems.
You know, Kevin, is there also a problem on the amount of interest they charge? Because doesn't it have to be a fair market rate? Or can you lend somebody at 1%?
Relating to a relative, your related party? That's a good question, Chuck. You put me on the spot here. It should be some of those loans do need to have the applicable federal rate to be true. But if you're charging a below interest loan and that's all you're paying, then that's all you can deduct. So.
Okay. Well, hopefully that answered your question.
Thank you so much. Very helpful.
We've got another caller on the line. RB has a question about student loans. RB, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
What is your advice to young people on how much they should be saving for their retirement, and also how much in debt should they go for an education?
Who's going to take this one?
Okay, that's a pretty broad question. Obviously, as far as planning for your retirement, I recommend that you try to save as much as you can. And we always tell young people, even the youngest people, I know I do some 401ks with companies, and one of the things I try to stress to the people in the employee meetings, even if you start doing the match, and it's a mathematical fact that if you save 10% of your income, you'll be better off than 90% of the people. And that's kind of a sad commentary in America, but it is the reality. So we tell people, if you're in a 401k, you've got to at least do the employer match and start out with that and see how your budget goes. And something I talk about in a book that I have coming out is the 80-20 rule. We always tell clients, if you can live on the 80-20 rule, where you live on 80% of your income, put 20% aside for a rainy day, you're going to come out extremely well. Now, you can't do that when you first start out in life, but eventually you want to work to that, to do that. But as far as college education, one of the things is what I would recommend and counsel people on in their college education is look at what you're getting that education for and what is that job going to pay you. And I would look at a college education like an investment in your life, because that's what it is. And I'd say if you're going to spend $150,000 on a college education to get a job that pays $20,000 a year, that's probably not a good investment. Now, if you're going to spend $150,000 a year to get a job that starts out at $50,000 to $70,000 a year, and you can get up to $200,000 or $300,000, that's a pretty good investment in your life. And I think a lot of people go to college for the wrong reason. They go to college to get a degree. They don't go to college to get the knowledge they need to have a job, to have a career. And there's a big difference between a job and a career. And I think that's one of the big things a lot of people miss is, what are you really trying to achieve in your life, and where do you really want to go? And it's like any other investment. When you're investing your money, what is the value you're going to get out of the money you're putting into that investment? What's going to be the return on your dollars? And that's the advice I would give to young people right now starting out in college. If you're going to go to college, a liberal arts college, and you're going to study if you're going to study art, and unless you're going to become a courier at one of the big art museums and you're going to make a lot of money, you probably don't have a lot of job opportunity. And I'd kind of caution against that. But I think if you go in there right now with, from Harry Dent talking about technology, I would think if a kid had the ability to work on computers, understanding technology, the changes in technology would be a great thing to be going to school about, because I think you'd have unlimited job opportunity ahead for you.
You know, Chuck, another thing that I would recommend to those to whom it appeals to some extent is, and it isn't for everybody, but the military. I was very fortunate enough to have an ROTC scholarship when I was in college, and in today's world, those things are phenomenal because they will pay you not only full tuition, but they'll pay you, you know, the stipend for books and all sorts of things, and if you do that for even for graduate school, then you do incur a larger obligation with the military. But if you're using your education to gain, you know, whether it's science, technology, or law, or whatever it is, something that is going to be useful to the military, then the likelihood is you're going to have a really good job in the military as well, as I did as a JAG officer, which was just a terrific thing. I was able to get out of my, after my law school, I didn't have them pay for law school. I could have, but I was a little bit concerned about incurring the obligation, the extra obligation for that. But I did get my college paid for that way. And so when I went to law school, then I borrowed some money. But when I went in the Air Force, I was able to pay my loans off in 2 years. So it can be a wonderful thing, especially, you know, I know people who do nursing and all different kinds of things, and they get a huge amount of money. And then they go in and they get great experience in an environment that is, you know, tends to be pretty good. So another possibility if you're interested.
Hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. You have a great weekend. Well, listen, we're going to get back to Kevin Stange, the tax investigator.
Well, you know, I've just been mulling around here our conversation with Harry Dent. And, you know, I'm certainly not an economist. I do get some interesting insight from the cross-section of clients that we have at Baker & Coulson. And it's just interesting to see, you know, how different businesses have gone through this last 5 years from 2008. And, you know, some of them have gone out of business. Some of them have had banner years during this time. And so I think Harry Dent even says this, that, you know, doom and gloom isn't necessarily doom and gloom. It's just the way things are, and there's a way to position yourself, you know, if that's the way things go, to you know, put yourself in a more positive financial position.
Well, the more knowledge you have about an environment, the more opportunity you have to survive in that. I know, Carl, I don't know if you did survival school in the Air Force. We had it in when I had my active duty in the Marine Corps Reserve, but they teach you survival school. One of the things about your environment is you try to get the max out of your environment. And that's the same thing, and that's why I tell people, if you want to sign up for Harry's newsletter, you can go to www.harrydent.com. And his Survive and Prosper is a daily email you get that talks about things about the economy. And I think with this coming crash that we're going to have, and we are going to have one, a lot of economists say we're not, but I happen to believe we are. The more knowledge you have, and even if you're wrong and you have a defensive strategy and a plan, you're still going to end up coming out making more money than you would have if you took a high risk. So I think you're exactly right, Kevin. The more knowledge you have, you can counteract that. It doesn't mean because we go into a recession that you can't make money in your investment portfolio.
Mm-hmm. You know, about 6-8 years ago, I was in the position to be looking at getting into a piece of real estate. And as I was looking at that, you know, I didn't have any necessarily insights into the economy and know that there was a bubble and any of this stuff. But it just did not feel right that I would be spending 50% of my income to buy basically a piece of junk, and that, you know, that I was, you know, probably making a little bit more than the median wage, and I couldn't afford a house that I thought was a decent investment at the same level. It was way down at the bottom. And so, I mean, just that alone should tell you this doesn't feel right. And so, I mean, you know, do the sniff test.
Well, you know, you're exactly right. And I tell clients that. I mean, I have people that come in and see us from the radio show and from our seminars and stuff. And I'll talk to them about their portfolio. And I always tell them to go home and think about it. And I always tell people, listen, I can give you all the statistical facts in the world, but your gut's got to tell you what's right for you. And if your gut tells you it's not right for you, then you shouldn't do it. I don't care what the advice is. You shouldn't do it. If you don't, it's like if you go to the doctor and he says you got terminal cancer, my gut would tell me I'm going to go get a second opinion, because what if he made a mistake?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think you got to play your gut intuition on that. And you were smart in doing that, because you were wise beyond your years.
Well, more like stumbled into it. So, well, you know, I won't go into my segment here, since we'll be coming into our last segment here shortly. But I will touch really briefly. I do have a chance to wade through articles for our listeners and bring what I think are some interesting things. And I got to tell you, I read an article that I thought was particularly bad, and I do have to talk about it a little bit. It was 10 estate planning mistakes. Now, they did have at least, a broken clock is right twice a day. So they did have a couple things that were decent, and I think that we should think about. The number one planning mistake would be procrastination. And I think we would all agree that it's just, if you don't know where to go, you tend to procrastinate. And that can be a bad thing if you don't have a plan in place. Number two would be the do-it-yourself mentality. And I think that carries a lot of weight also, where sometimes it's just best to have somebody who knows what they're doing, knows the fine print, knows other angles to look at for your situation, and I think you get a lot of bang for your buck for that. But a couple things that were on there. A top 10 estate planning mistake, forgetting to consider your pets in your estate plan. I just don't put that in the top 10. I'm sorry. If that's where we've come down to, if you've alienated all of your relatives, then yes, maybe you need to consider your pet. But this just doesn't ring true to me. And then the last one is failure to consider your digital assets. I don't put that in the top 10 either. The 70s music collection that you pirated off of the internet, some things are just best left to die with you. So anyway, I will leave that with the we'll wrap up the Tax Investigator and go to our next break.
Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come right back and wrap up the show. Actually, we won't. I think, let's take a quick break and we'll come right back and we'll wrap up with last introductions. And
we only do have 2 minutes
okay,
left.
Okay, well, yeah. Kevin, how else can we get a hold of you?
We're at BakerColson.com, 2414 Northeast Division, out the east side of Gresham. Our phone number is 503-666-5569.
And Carl?
Warren Allen, 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue. 503-255-8795 and warrenallen.com.
Yep, and Price Financial Group Wealth Management, pfgwm.com on the web. We're located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103 in Portland, Oregon, in Mall 205 area. And you can reach us at 503-253-3000. Thank you very much, and listen next week to Investing Simplified.
We do Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is